Welcome to what I think may be the 16th Gallybeggar Press podcast, although in all honesty, I've kind of lost count because it's quite a while since we've put one of these out. But we want to do it now because we have something very special to share, which is Adam Biles in conversation with Ian Dunt, recorded in Waterstones, Trafalgar Square on the 20th of September 2023 to celebrate the launch of Adam's incredible novel, Beasts of England. Adam will of course be familiar to listeners of this podcast as the author of Beasts of England and The Great Feeding Time, and Ian Dunt should be familiar as he is one of the most eloquent and impressive political commentators of our age, not to mention a wonderful writer himself. His book, How to Be a Liberal, for instance, is not just an informative and entertaining guide to the history of liberal thought, it's an inspiration. It makes you feel not only that there are real values that we can aspire towards for the betterment of humanity, but that such aspirations do not have to involve dogma or preclude curiosity. It makes you feel that intellectual flexibility and compassion can still have a place in the world. And such thinking, of course, makes Ian the ideal person to interview Adam about Beasts of England. So let's get to it.
Hello, everyone. I have my notes on my phone, so I'm not checking Twitter. Okay, that's not what's actually going on right now. I'm actually probably sort of in charge of what's going on here. Look, it's been an absolutely fucking dreadful day of abject hypocrisy from the Prime Minister, who keeps on telling us about his long-term plans while trying to sabotage the world for the young. So it seems like a good time to talk about George Orwell and the misuse of English language. My name is Ian Dutt. I'm a columnist for the Eye newspaper. I am the author of How Westminster Works and Why It Doesn't. And more importantly, for our discussion today, I've been described by the New Statesman as the poor man's George Orwell, which was meant as an attack, I think, but is in fact the nicest thing that anyone's ever said to me.
And
I took it very gratefully. Yeah, so that was good. And this is Adam Biles, who has just written the sequel to Animal Farm. I should also say that you work in Shakespeare and Company Bookshop in Paris, probably the nicest bookshop in the history of man. And are the literary director?
Yeah, I don't know what it means either.
I feel reassured by that. That's good. I have this image. So we've met a couple of times. You've interviewed me before. We had a bottle of wine in Paris last summer. And you seem very gentle and pleasant and nice. From reading your book, what I've concluded is that there's a real seething rage underneath this exterior. Yeah. Would you like to talk about that rage?
Sure. it's funny, actually. When my first book came out, novel called Feeding Time, an elderly journalist in Paris who I'd known a little bit came up to me, and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "Adam, I thought you were such a pleasant young man." And that was all he said, and then he sort of drifted off. And so, yeah, I realised there is a bit of a sort of dissociation between the image I present and obviously what is going on inside and what ends up on the page. This particular book was born out of, I guess, a rage and a frustration. I guess the frustration was, I'd been out of the UK for the longest time ever, in fact. So I've lived in Paris for close to two decades. But for various reasons, I didn't get back there much in 2019. And then, of course, 2020 came along and the pandemic, and I couldn't get back there. Mm-hmm. And so when I started writing this book in 2021, I had been watching everything that had been going on in the UK sort of since the Brexit vote, essentially, with a certain despair and a sense of sort of, and this is kind of a weird thing to say, but if I could get back there, maybe I could do something. Yeah. And I don't know what I would have done. Like I don't think there's, you know, there's a great deal that one individual can do, but I just, that connection was, that disconnection felt very frustrating. And I was also just watching, you know, I guess I lived out of the country for so long, but I have lots of family and friends here. And there was a lot of mismanagement of different things politically all over the world in the last sort of 5 or 10 years. But Britain really seemed to lead the world in corruption and incompetence and just sort of just kind of a smallness as well in its approach. Mm. And so I wanted to write something. I wanted to get this out and get it on the page. And so I started writing these things connected to the COVID press conferences. So what would happen was the press conferences would come out, and then I'd take to my computer and write these little kind of behind the scenes sketches which were very, like, if you can imagine, like, what a, like a Martin Rosen cartoon on, in text. That was kind of the tone of them. And I'd write them out very quickly, and it was quite cathartic. And then I would look at them maybe a week later, and even I had forgotten what they were about. And I'm not the kind of writer who writes and then publishes and you know, gets sort of an instant reaction, because I like to draft and redraft and redraft. And so I realized that these were, you know, they might be helping me in a way, but they weren't going to do anything, to have an impact. Nobody's going to read them. And even a week later, I didn't know what I was particularly referring to. And then I started reading Orwell again, not Animal Farm, but some of his essays. And in one of the, I think it was in the preface to the Ukrainian edition of Animal Farm, it was in his collected essays, he said that Animal Farm was the first book that fused his artistic purpose with his political purpose. And I found that really interesting, just as a concept. Like, I've often thought that, like, political purpose and artistic purpose can't really go together. Mm. Because if you've got a political purpose, then it automatically becomes propaganda, and then that's not art. And yet Orwell believed he could do it, and I believe he did do it with Animal Farm. And it's also that thing, I guess, of political purpose. He didn't say a political point or a political moral. He said a purpose. Like, he wanted it to have an effect. He wanted it to have an impact. He wanted it to change things. And so it occurred to me that, yeah, maybe this could be the way. And, like, you know, I'm under no illusions about how novels can change the world. Like, I think, unfortunately, I don't know, but like, their power is very limited. But I am a fiction writer, so, like, if I'm going to do something, that is going to be the vein that I will channel this rage and this frustration.
What's Orwell's status in France? I sort of always got the impression that they thought there was a slight sort of condescension, like, oh, the English would love him because he doesn't really have the capacity for abstract thought.
I think there's a sense of it. Like, the novels are read and loved, and there have been some recent translations of Animal Farm, actually, which has brought it back to, I think since Orwell went out of copyright, there's been a kind of a glut of them. And in fact, graphic novels, like, there was a graphic novel, I think, by a Brazilian writer, came out a couple of years ago and did really, really well, sold like about 100,000 copies. So there's definitely an interest, there's definitely a taste. But I think, yeah, I do think in France there is a little bit of a sort of a condescending opinion of sort of any sort of British political philosophy.
Jesus Christ, okay, it's worse than I thought. I've had this thing in London. I've had to twice in two separate flats that I've lived in London, I've had to walk by a blue plaque with Orwell's name on it on my way to work.
Yeah.
Which is fucking terrible as a journalist. It's just like, oh, just fuck off, Eric. I can't live. I can't work if I've got you looking over my shoulder the whole time. Presumably you really felt him looking over your shoulder. Does it feel daunting, or do you feel like a sense of responsibility towards him?
Yeah, I would say I didn't feel him looking over my shoulder. I had a kind of fear that, and I don't know who these people are, but I had in mind this sense of kind of, there are Orwell people out there who will not like what I have done. Like, who will feel a certain sort of possessiveness to this writer. And as soon as I do it, as soon as the book comes out, then you know, I'll receive this drubbing by this sort of nebulous group of people who perhaps don't even exist.
They definitely do exist.
Okay, so I should still brace myself for this show. And there was a big thing, like, for me, this was an experiment in a sense. Like, I was writing it in the, not quite in the depths of the pandemic, but in early 2021 was when the first draft was written. And I was, you know, we were mostly cut off from each other at that point. I was on furlough from the bookshop, so I was kind of cut off from the world of books and the world of literature and from other writers as well. And so when I was actually writing it, I had no real sense of whether it would come to anything. Like, the amount of projects I start, which after a week, a month, sometimes several years, I end up abandoning and then working on something else. Like, it could have been one of those. And the experiment I wanted to try was to see whether I could deploy the tools that Orwell had created to try and understand what was going on. Because I think Orwell knew what was going on and created the tools to talk about it. And so I was in a slightly different position. I didn't really understand what was going on, but thought, well, maybe if I kind of slightly parasitically put myself into the world that he has created and kind of move around in it and and deploy certain, you know, characters and certain situations. Maybe this sort of structure, this sort of dynamic that he's created will help me at least to come to some sort of understanding of what was going on.
We're going to, throughout this conversation, we're not, it's quite difficult because it's a fiction book. So we're not, I don't want to spoil anything in it, which sounds absurd because it's covering our recent political history. Mm. And you know, you guys know what happens in Animal Farm. And if you don't, you're very naughty and you really fucking should. But there is a real delight in sort of discovering this really quite complex tapestry of political points that you were making in that book. And we have to talk about it in a slightly abstract way all the time, not to give too much of it away. But like the closest comparison I could think of was actually weirdly the Watchmen TV series on HBO.
Oh, yeah.
That took the original stuff and just took most of the characters behind, but kept the iconography, mm-hmm. sort of kept the core themes that were like the moral commitment, but applied them in a more modern sort of setting. And you find that, I mean, the chief thing there really is, I think, your rage over the misuse of language,
yes.
and the mutilation of truth in uh-huh. modern politics.
Yeah, I think so. Like, it was one of the, in certain reviews of the book, one of the things that's been said several times, which I kind of agree with, actually, is that compared to Orwell's book, it's much more complicated. Like, there are a lot more threads, there's a lot more going on, there's a lot more strands. And, you know, sometimes this is kind of leveled as an observation, sometimes it's leveled as a sort of a mild criticism. And my response to that is, yeah, but you know, have you seen what's going on? Like, in a sense, like, Orwell was lucky he had a relatively straightforward situation to allegorize. Like, you know, mm-hmm. there were the characters of the Russian Revolution, and he sticks to them pretty closely. And you know, it's a very sort of quite limited, quite closed system. Whereas I realized very quickly after I'd had the idea and I started working it, that it's not going to be the short book. You know, it's still relatively short, certainly compared to my first book, but it's before which I apologize. But it's it was going to be more complex. There were going to be lots more layers to it, and it was interesting for me to see whether the form of the allegory could resist these layers in a way, like, or whether it would just kind of collapse under the strain of it. And it's not for me to say whether it resists. I think it resists just about, but there were definitely moments in it, even when like reading it back, where I feel the allegory bursting at the seams by the sheer complexity of the situation and the sheer weight of material of the situation that I was trying to allegorize.
To give one example of this, there are some starlings. Mm-hmm. And this, I can do that. I don't think this is a spoiler, but this is to give an example of the way
this very early.
They come very early, and they sort of appear, but they are, I mean, unless I catastrophically misjudge this, they're basically Twitter.
What?
No, you're
right. You're an arsehole. And they their presence in the sky and the sort of judgmentalism of, mm-hmm. of the birds and the way they sort of like go for anyone who steps slightly out of line socially creates this really kind of anxious, kind of throbbing sense to that book as it goes through. So it has the thing that all has of that kind of almost as a children's story, mm-hmm. here as a representation of the thing. But actually it becomes this thing that kind of communicates emotionally much more than you would necessarily think of as just the idea in its own right.
Yeah, and also it became a very flexible part of the book in a way. Like it took me a long time to because I realized quite early on that it was, again, like Orwell, you know, I don't mean to do him down, but he had it easy, you know, like all of his characters.
Everyone says that about him.
Yeah, yeah,
especially when he got imprisoned during the Spanish Civil War. Yeah.
Like, he, in this particular context, he, you know, he was dealing with essentially one plane of existence. And since what, like the mid-90s, I guess, our world has in a sense been divided into, at the very least, two planes of existence. Like the what we call the real or the physical world where people actually interact in meet space, and then this other plane of the internet, and actually probably not other plane but other planes. There are so many different levels to the internet, and I was trying to think, like, how could you bring that onto the farmyard? And obviously it's like when most sort of ideas that really take root, it was sort of staring me in the face. Like, you open you know, you open Twitter and there's a picture of a bird there, but it actually took me kind of an embarrassingly long time to think, oh yeah, well, why not birds? And then you see these beautiful pictures of like murmurations of starlings and the sort of the shapes they can form, and the sort of the shapes they form are interesting because from the ground we read, you know, like we do with clouds, we read meaning into them and we read purpose into them, but we don't really understand what they are. That's kind of a whole projection. And so I had this idea, I thought, okay, is this going to work? And then suddenly, like, funny enough, I wasn't even thinking about, for example, AI and, you know, this whole kind of thing of sort of generation of images and deep fakes and things like that. That wasn't particularly on my mind when I was writing it. But weirdly enough, when I'm reading it back, it's in there, actually. And I realized that this quite simple metaphor actually allowed me to do and say quite a lot of things connected to the sort of, not just Twitter, but the whole sort of realm of cyberspace.
Do you feel that way about social media? The way that your stylings made me feel when I was reading the book, of this kind of oppressive, kind of almost like a Greek chorus in the background at any moment, ready to just step in and destroy you socially?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not on it. So, no, I don't feel it in that sense. You know, like I don't tweet personally. Like I sometimes do some tweets and stuff for the bookshop. So
you send me some pretty fruity DMs.
Well, yes, of course, but that's I thought that was between us. But I do have a sense that social media, as it has developed, is a broadly destructive force on our societies. I don't think it's inherently needs to be so. Like, I think it's just because I suppose, like, I don't have a developed theory about this, but my hunch is that because it's connected to capitalism, like, it's not, you know, it's people behave as if it's a public space, but it's not a public space. It's a kind of, it's a monetized space. It's a space in which the people who own these networks have an interest in certain types of reactions being provoked. And unfortunately, probably, you know, because of something in human nature, the reactions which are sort of hostile or which generate these, you know, so-called Twitter storms are probably the ones that generate the most money or generate the most engagement and therefore the most money for these networks. So I don't think sort of as a concept, social media need be like that. But I think the way in which we've allowed it to grow is very much like that, yeah.
So go back to the writing. There are certain scenes which play out almost exactly as a sort of echo of scenes in Animal Farm. And there is that style of writing that is very, very hard to do and very easy to read, which is simple sentences, quite short sentences.
Yeah.
Essentially, kind of almost childlike sentences, which is his original intention.
Yeah.
And then there are moments where it feels like you veer off from him. I mean, you're much warmer and the characters are much more fully developed.
Uh-huh.
And there's a sort of frivolity, I suppose, to your personality that has to come out, which I don't think anyone has ever accused George Orwell of being frivolous.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't...
Is anything that I just said true, by the way?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Like, I think the... like, I wasn't particularly raised or shaped, let's say, by literature. Certain books, like, but I think there's a certain aesthetic which maybe is a sort of aesthetic you get from Roald Dahl books, or like as a, you know, quite young, probably too young child, was, you know, watching things like the Young Ones or reading comics like Viz. And I think it's funny, actually, there's a moment in one of Orwell's essays where he talks about, like, you can learn a lot about the English from the seaside postcards. And yet, Orwell is not a particularly kind of seaside postcard kind of guy. In fact, Animal Farm, like, there's not much humour in there at all. And so it's quite striking when there is a moment. So I think of the moment where the pigs discover whiskey.
Yes.
And then Squealer comes out and he's, oh, Comrade Napoleon is dying. And everyone has to kind of mourn and wail and sort of beat their chest. And then later in the day, it's like, oh, Comrade Napoleon is maybe not dying, actually. It's probably okay. And then by the end of the day, the pigs are learning how to distill whiskey. Mm-hmm. And so they're quite few and far between. And so I realised two things. Like, when I knew the book was going to be longer, I think, you know, adult readers probably have a certain patience threshold with talking animals. And I reckon Orwell maybe pitched it about right. So if I'm going to ask people to then spend more time with talking animals than that, then it's going to have to be entertaining. It's going to have to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, I think there is a sort of a misunderstanding sometimes about humour and comedy, that it is in some way less serious. Something is in some way less serious if it's funny. And I don't believe that. I think that humour and comedy are one of the most sort of fundamentally serious pursuits in sort of in human existence. Like, I think faced with the sort of the inherent absurdity of life and the universe, mm. like laughing at that is probably one of the most kind of profound things that one can do. So I think, like, just, you know, it is a funnier book than Orwell's, but I think it's the seriousness of its purpose is, you know, it's not diminished because of that. Concerning like the character development, I think there's two things going on there. I think one of maybe Orwell's sort of blind spots or sort of weaknesses is that he does tend to maybe slightly romanticize the working class. Mm. And so, you know, and the trouble is when you romanticize something, you decomplexify it and you dehumanize it. And so with the character of Boxer, mm. who is sort of essentially stands in for the working class in sort of Soviet Russia, like he is credulous and he is naive and he is loyal and he meets a very sticky end. And I realized
it's very good, by the way.
You can't do that now. Like, I don't think people would put up with this kind of saying, this group of people are represented by this animal and yes. this is how all of these people are. And that was quite a challenge when writing the book, realized, okay, how can we sort of still set it on the farmyard, but without kind of giving the sense of like, everyone within this group is the same, like, you know, these kind of all cows are this way, all sheep are this way, and they represent different levels mm-hmm. of society. So I think it was in bringing out sort of specific characters in within each of those groups that I hoped at least to kind of avoid that sort of decomplexifying of of certain groups in society.
That point on humour is interesting, right? There's a really difficult relationship between humour and politics, and specifically political change.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the classic complaint that's made about satire is it just doesn't change anything. And I always thought it was quite a tedious and irritating complaint. But then it was funny, I started talking to lots of people who write satire, and they were like, well, my main problem is it doesn't change anything. Uh-huh. And I thought, oh, right, maybe I should take the complaint a bit more seriously, because it's clearly a problem for them. Does that haunt you at all, or do you...
Not really. Like, you know, I think I have a quite realistic expectation of what books can actually do to check. Like, I think books are probably still the most kind of subversive medium of communication that we have. I still don't think, you know, I don't think film or television or music can quite get into somebody's mind in the way that a book can. But it is a kind of, it's a one-on-one connection as well. It's one mind connecting with another mind. And the hope is, you know, is when you write a book, it'll be your mind connecting with lots of other minds, mm-hmm. but it's not a kind of communal experience in that way. So I don't have any expectations, for example, of this book of really having any sort of real world impact in that sense. But I do think laughter can make a difference. Like, there's an amazing video of Ceausescu, like, he's giving a speech, and somebody in the crowd starts heckling and laughing at him. And literally within a week, he was gone. Like, there was something in that gesture which broke the spell of this decades-long dictatorship. And once the people were able to laugh at him, it just everything collapsed after that. And I think that is something which is not given enough acknowledgement, actually. It's that kind of, you know, the moment, the way that kind of the pointing out of an absurdity can at times kind of gather a momentum and can sort of can bring about real change.
That's surely true, right? Like, I mean, when you look at was looking at complaints recently from senior Nazi figures in the early days of the regime, mm-hmm. talking about how many really quite minor kind of pub jokes had been picked up and sent to Gestapo, and they're wasting Gestapo time on. Uh-huh. Like, do we really need to spend this time on someone, you know, just taking the piss out of Goebbels? And they're like, no, you do. Mm-hmm. Because if they understand even a squeak of dissent can get through, then the whole system starts to fall.
Yeah. And that's funny, like, Orwell had a sense, and this was something I wanted to sort of interrogate, I guess, with the book. Like, when he was writing The Lion and the Unicorn, and when he was seeing what was happening in Europe with sort of fascism and authoritarianism, he did think that there was a certain resistance in England or in Britain to this kind of ideological fervour and this sort of serious, you know, sort of taking these ideas, taking these concepts so seriously that you would act upon them. And I think he put that down to a certain hypocrisy in the, I mean, I say the English or the British, he was very loose actually in his, in, you know, he would use those terms quite interchangeably. And there's a moment where he said something like, well, sums it up, there's this pub song that was popular at the time, which where it was like, you can't do that there, here. And I give something like, you can't do that there, here. You can't do that there, here. Over there, you can do that there, but you can't do that there, here. And he said, I think that is maybe something in that. That's the British response. And that's why we're never going to kind of fall for these kind of characters that the Europeans have fallen for. And then I was looking at the kind of characters that British people have fallen for over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. And I was just, well, maybe you can do that there, here. Like, you know, maybe either the British people have changed or Orwell was wrong about this kind of inherent resistance to those ideas, like, by, you know, maybe there were limits to the things that the English or the British would take, sort of would be able to mock. And sometimes, maybe that's part of the secret. Like, maybe it's when we stop mocking and start taking seriously that things start to go wrong.
Well, this, I mean, look, it's not a spoiler to say that, like, one of the central characters in the book, and again, I may be wrong, but I'm definitely not, is an appalling creature which seems to resemble Boris Johnson to an almost uncanny extent. Mm-hmm. The thing is, he was in on the joke. The whole image that Johnson presented was, I'm in on the gag. There's kind of, he was kind of like an ironic creation.
Yeah.
So it was almost like, you can do that stuff there, here. I wish you hadn't brought that up, because I don't think I can say that sentence properly in one go.
Can't do that there, either.
I can't, please stop doing it now. But he could, by virtue of acting like actually he was involved in the joke.
Yeah.
And maybe that it's by harnessing the joke that actually in Britain you can just do some really terrible things to society.
Yeah, no, I think that's very insightful. But I think it's also, it was a similar case with Trump as well. Mm-hmm. Like there's a strange kind of immunity to people who just will kind of front it out. If you tell them, no, that's a lie, so, no, that's not a lie. So, no, but that's factually incorrect. No, you may say that, but it's not the case. And there's a certain, like, yeah, brazenness to these kind of figures, which maybe just does override all that kind of, that mockingness. It's just to sort of consistently and repeatedly refuse to accept sort of criticisms. Mm. That ultimately it gives them a certain, almost like a superpower in a way.
There's, how to put this? Your concern, obviously, is with these kind of, was basically with the rejection of truth and the manipulation of language, the primary concern. And that is exactly what Orwell's primary concern is. I was kind of struck by that all the way through. You're sort of like, you have managed to avoid ever making it look like you're holding them to be equivalent, you know, mm-hmm. the lies of Stalin versus, right. you know, the lies of Boris Johnson, which is quite a difficult path to tread. But actually, it's a more profound thing than that, isn't it? Which is that, like, how come these Orwell kind of mechanisms and forums that you mm-hmm. brought over just deploy so easily into the current state where you can just see the exact same parallel happening over and over again? So it kind of widens your eye to just how obscene much of the stuff we've lived through in the last few years has been.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with the language and the corruption of language and the perversion of language. Like, I remember reading Animal Farm for the first time at school and not really having a sense of the Russian Revolution at all. And I remember the moments which were the kind of the gut punches of the novel, were those moments when the rules of the revolution or the mottos had been changed, and just seeing it started off with no animal shall sleep in a bed with an animal shall sleep in a bed, and then it becomes no animal shall sleep in a bed with sheets. And this, I really profoundly remember that feeling of kind of the sort of the devilishness and the brilliance and the horror of that. And I think it's not a direct parallel with what we've been living through now. In a funny kind of way, like at least in that context, you know, anyone reading that sentence, they've seen the sentence has been changed, has been perverted, but like, at least they will all still agree what a bed is and what sheets are and what animals are. Like the terms of the sentence have not been sort of fractured. What we're the context we're living in now, I think, is sort of even more fraught in that we can't even agree on what words mean, or what they stand for, or what they represent. And that's not to say, like, obviously, you know, words do change over time, but there is a difference. And I think this sort of is, if I remember right, it's spelled out quite explicitly in the book, like there is a difference between words changing over time and people intentionally and with kind of malice aforethought changing the meaning of words for a political end. Mm. And that was the thing, I suppose, that sort of is the sort of the slightly different terrain I was working on compared to Orwell, was that fracturing of common ground of understanding and of like what constitutes reality.
Well, you start it with a kind of gag, basically, of apples and pears, and apples become pears and vice versa, and you managed to keep that gag going for much longer than I expected you to. But is your view then that sort of like once you allow that crack in meaning and in truth to open up on even quite trivial things, for instance, like, you know, how much money you might send to the NHS on the side of a bus, for instance, you know, then you sort of unleash it in a potentially much more disturbing and societal way.
Yeah, I think so. I think, and that was one of the interesting things when kind of plotting out the book, because a lot of it was kind of reverse engineered. I knew where I wanted to get to, but I wasn't quite sure where I was going to start. And so there were a few scenes from recent sort of political history. So do you remember that the press conference that Johnson and Gove gave the morning after the Brexit vote? Well, they were just stunned. Like, they didn't expect it to happen, and they were just sort of bewildered and just quite scared, actually, by the magnitude of what they had kind of almost inadvertently done. Like, I don't think either of them really wanted, Gove maybe a little more, but Johnson, you know, his big plan was that he'd campaign for Leave. People wouldn't vote for it, but then that would propel him to the leadership of the Conservative Party. So that was one of the images. There was another one was Trump's inauguration. I remember watching that from my office at the bookstore. And just, you know, he was giving that whole American carnage speech. Mm. And just the sort of surrounded by this sort of fascistic iconography, which at the same time was the iconography of the American Republic, just tweaked slightly, and it just took a tweak and it became something a lot more sinister. And the third thing was the murder of Joe Cox, which the event in itself, which was harrowing and horrible and both on a human level and on a political level, but just that feeling in the days after it happened was like, oh, this is going to change a thing. Like, you know, this, people are not going to rein in their rhetoric. They're not going to like take a step back and say, oh god, you know, maybe we're in part responsible for this. Like, you know, that was sort of, and so these three things. But then where was I going to start? And I started sort of tracing it back, saying, okay, so, you know, the Brexit vote, and then, you know, obviously you have to come back to austerity, and then you have to come back to the financial crisis, and then, but then I realized actually that's not when the decay in sort of trust in politics began. Like, it was never sort of thriving, but like, you had then the MP's expenses scandal before that, and I came to this kind of quite uncomfortable realization, and particularly as somebody who grew up in the 90s and was very excited about the arrival of New Labour and sort of, you know, and regardless of what Tony Blair became, like as someone who's born under Thatcher and was excited that she's being deposed, suddenly realized, oh, God, you know, like a lot of this can be traced back to the way that Blair and Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell sort of just, you know, manipulated the media and like in certain sort of ways, which maybe at the time seemed quite sort of useful and not particularly sinister. But given the context of where we've arrived, maybe, you know, it's almost like it felt like it was sowing the seeds for or allowing a certain behavior to grow in the sort of the cracks that they had created.
And let's take some questions from you guys, and then we'll go back to chatting for a while. Does anyone have questions? Excellent, fantastic. Yes, hello.
Hi, I just thought the point about language. Now, my experience has largely been in Germany, East Germany. Mm-hmm. So,
okay.
And Victor Klemperer, I think, wrote a book. Well, I know he wrote a book about what language meant in various parts of Germany and how people can distort that language. And my take on it. Such as it is, sort of listening to you, is that we have to, in order to cope with what people think about language now, or the way they use language now, whether it is Britain or the United States or wherever, we have to have coping mechanisms. Otherwise, we would go batshit crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I feel, you know, that this whole thing, you know, the anti-fascistica protection wall was the Berlin Wall, you know, and those two very different interpretations of the same thing.
I
think we're going through it particularly in this country. Obviously I live here now, so I don't know. I just think people would like to have a revolution if they could. The English aren't necessarily predisposed to that, but what are the coping mechanisms? I'm sorry, this is a bit of a ramble. I don't know. I just think that we need to have coping mechanisms to deal with what people are doing to the language.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it's something which I struggled with in the writing, and having since finished it, which I've struggled with since, is this sense of, because one of the things in the book is this idea of kind of a lack of clarity about history. And the events of history, like I think a big part of the whole campaign about Brexit was this sort of strange mythologizing of the Second World War. And in a sense, by people who were either children during the Second World War or born not long after that. Mm. And so didn't have any direct experience of it. And in a sense, it's not really their fault, because I think a lot of the kind of the common experience was that people who came back from the war didn't really talk about it with their kids. And so their kids got their information from wherever they could get their information, which was the comic books or, you know, the sort of the propaganda war films and things like that. And so they grew up with this sort of this slightly distorted view of history. And I think, you know, when you hear people like Farage talk about, you know, he speaks almost like he fought in the Second World War, but in fact, you know, he was born. He's surprisingly young, actually.
He's younger than I am. He's
the same age as Keanu Reeves, I believe, which is sort of quite a sort of an unsettling thing to process. But in a sense, so I'm very much for this kind of this expansion of our understanding of history, and, you know, bringing in more context, understanding that sort of, you know, this idea that colonial soldiers fought in the Second World War is only really now being brought to sort of general consciousness. And yet at the same time, once you have introduced all this information, it's quite disorienting, like, because you can't then tread a kind of a clear narrative through it, because there are so many different narratives and so many different stories. And I think that's quite destabilizing for people. And so I think all of us, like, quite naturally, then we'll kind of adhere, so we'll cling to a particular story. But then if I cling to one story and you cling to another story, and there are elements of that which are contradictory, or at least, you know, rub up against each other, then I guess there's more potential for conflict. And I haven't got any sort of solution to that. I'm not quite sure how to find a way through this kind of this desire and this need to tell as many stories as possible, while also finding a common ground in which people can discuss, you know, with the same or similar references. And I think that's one of the things that makes the situation today particularly fraught.
There's also a danger, isn't there, that some of the words that we like to use in modern debate are designed not so much to describe a thing, but to show which side of it you're on.
Mm.
So if you take the word denial versus skepticism for climate change, for COVID, you know, for lockdowns, you know, if you say denial, we know which side you're on. If you say I'm a lockdown skeptic, also reasonable, you know, then you can tell which side. And so these words are not really used to designate something except your own tribal membership or something. And that then makes communication actually quite hard.
Yeah. And I think this comes back to social media as well. Like, I remember when Martin Amis died quite recently, at the bookshop we put out a conversation that he had with Will Self at a festival from like 2010. And one thing that Amis says there, which I thought was really pertinent, this was kind of pre-social media really, was that he said, you know, if you're having a discussion with somebody, the moment that you say to somebody, you are a racist or you said something misogynist, he said, like, that may be true, but don't expect the conversation to continue after that point. Like, you've set up a dividing line and suddenly, you know, now you're going to be kind of throwing things at each other across that dividing line. And I think social media encourages that dividing line. And so that I think a lot of conversation, like before working at the bookstore, I was a language teacher for about 10 years. And I would go to be sent out to sort of offices around Paris and teach people in like banks or whatever. And you would have lessons with, like, you know, the big managers and like the traders, but also the receptionists and the cleaners and things like that. And one thing that really came out of that after kind of hundreds, thousands of hours of conversations with people from every sort of level of French society was actually kind of, broadly speaking, most people have the same values and believe in the same things and want the same things. But because of the way they express them and the way they are taught to articulate them and the way that perhaps certain social pressures or online pressures divide them into certain camps, we don't recognize this. And of course, people, you know, the traders don't speak with the cleaners, so that divide is never really bridged. But I think there are probably, you know, a lot of, and even across the, you know, I consider my political home to be broadly on the left, the centre left. But that was one thing that was interesting, I guess, about the debates around Brexit, suddenly sort of, finding yourself agreeing with conservatives who were anti-Brexit and finding really, actually there was this dividing line, which I had decided, you know, I'd adhered to, like most people, suddenly realised, maybe actually it isn't quite as straightforward as, you know, all people on the left think this, all people on the right think that, and these people are good people and these people are assholes.
Actually, I mean, those people I'd be sat next to are commonly on the same position during the Brexit years, and I just think, like, it's a good litmus test of how fucked we are. You and I are sat on the same team right now, and I really want to get back to the world where we're on different teams. That's much more natural. Do we have another question? Questions. Come on, someone put their hand up. Yes, thank you. It's incredible. You just say that every time, you just say it, and people do it. Actually, they eventually do. It's amazing.
It's a bit of a follow up in a way. The earlier question about coping mechanisms. You started off, Adam, by saying there's a smallness to what had been happening in Britain. I know exactly what you mean by that. I think certainly it chimes. It's a kind of paucity of ambition and a paucity of stature of the politicians involved, compared to this really simple world that Orwell had to deal with, as this massive revolution led by people like Stalin, and whatever else you think of them, you know, was not a small figure. But I think is there an issue there about we've trained ourselves to think of this as small and insignificant, and we can't do anything about it, and it doesn't really matter, and it doesn't, you know, these politicians aren't going to do what they say anyway. And they don't believe in anything. And perhaps that's a good idea, because when you believe in big things, they go really, really bad. And as a result, we allow a bunch of incredibly corrupt, incompetent, and self-serving people to run a country really, really, really badly.
Yeah.
And in reality, the issues are not small. You know, a couple of hundred thousand people die from COVID. Probably didn't need to. Mm. You know, the climate is going to be destroyed because somebody in Hillingdon didn't like Eulers. You know, that kind of stuff is not actually small. But we've sort of, it's a coping mechanism. We've kind of allowed ourselves to do it, and the way that we live with that is to snark on Twitter.
Yeah.
Do you think that makes us complicit?
Before you answer that, that was a very articulate question. And can the rest of you just make it a bit shitter? Because it makes it
a bit
There's a few things I'd like to say. Like, I think one thing I found very interesting and kind of surprising over recent years is the way repeatedly people like Boris Johnson or people like Trump, one of the sort of weapons in their arsenal, and you see it, once you've seen it, you realize they're deploying it, you see them deploying it again and again and again, is this kind of, that we're all as bad as each other. You know, like, I'm a bit of an asshole, but like, these guys are assholes too. It's sort of like, and it's I think it's a very pernicious thing. Like, I think there are people who go into politics, I think probably like the majority on all sides of the political spectrum, who do want to make a difference. Like, unless, I think there's probably a part in most people going to politics, maybe I could be prime minister, but actually you're probably disabused of that quite quickly. And you do work on, you know, whether you're a national politician or a local politician. Yeah, if there's a lot of hard slog, and like, it's something which I wouldn't want to do, like, God, it's thank God there are these people out there doing that, because it's, you know, and then to hear them all being tarnished with the same brush of like, oh, we're all just as bad as each other, we're all on the make, so you might as well vote for the guy who's on the make and entertains you rather than the guy who's on the make and this is just a bit dull. Like, I think that is incredibly pernicious and very, very present. Concerning the complicity, when I was, I think I began with an idea of kind of a plague on the Brexiters and Boris Johnson and nationalists and neo-fascists and, you know. And then as I continued writing, then that kind of, that plague spread. And it was kind of a plague on, for example, the far left and how, you know, people, I guess, like Corbyn had sort of, to my mind, allowed, sort of distant the left so far from power that they couldn't then get in there and make a difference and kind of, you know, kick out these people who were causing so much trouble. And then the plague spread more, and I was thinking about, and this is where it got a bit uncomfortable, because it was spread to where I might consider my political home, which is kind of the centre left, and just thinking like, and you guys didn't see this coming, and you were so stuck with your idea of what politics is, which is sort of like, well, if you give people a rational argument for how their lives will improve by doing these taxes, you know, then we'll be like, politics, you know, it does work by argument, but it also works by emotion and it works by the gut. Like, you know, when I, during the Brexit referendum, I spoke to people and I made the arguments that we were all making about the economy and stuff, but that's probably not the reason I voted to remain in the European Union. I voted because, you know, my life has been shaped by it, and in ways that I know my life was made better by, in so many ways, by the fact this institution existed. Like, you know, my partner is French, my daughter now is, you know, is bi-national and so dual national. So like, there was definitely something much more emotional. And I suddenly realized, oh, that was like the idiocy in the sense of the center is kind of not acknowledging that and allowing the extremes on both sides, in a sense, to kind of appeal to those emotions and then sort of exploit them and win because of them. So then I found myself in the situation of really like a plague on all your houses. And then I realized that wasn't probably fair either, because, you know, it's not just a plague on your houses, because like, I'm in this too. Like, it's, and I sort of, maybe it's a plague on all of our houses. Like, maybe we've all been a little bit neglectful and a little bit careless and a little bit shit. Like, maybe, you know, that's sort of, that might be, oh, well, you know, the environment's fat, so let's not bother, you know, recycling or something like that. You know, I could probably say many occasions where I have not carried the bottle the extra 100 metres to put it in the recycling, or, you know, these little kind of gestures. And or maybe, you know, we've had a lazy political opinion because it's where we felt most comfortable, and or we haven't really reflected about it, or we haven't learnt enough or engaged enough with the subject. And then I did wonder, like, this is not in any way a developed political idea, but it suddenly occurred to me that, well, maybe if a lot of this has been brought about by all of us, or a lot of us, most of us, being a little bit shit, if we were all a little bit less shit, could we reverse the direction of that vicious circle? Because I think that's one of the things with being, with, like, for example, particularly with the environmentalism, I think it's a very common feeling to have this sense of, oh, because the problem is so enormous. So, like, we're never going to surmount it, so why bother? Like, there's this kind of real defeatism, which I have felt too. But I do wonder, and as I say, this is not a rigorously thought out political position, but suddenly, like, maybe if we all had, you know, yeah, we were all a bit less shit. Like, it's a bit like those, you know, those bracelets. It's like, what would Jesus do? Like, ABLS, a bit less shit. And, like, and if we all just made that little effort, perhaps we could turn this around. And that thought came to me while writing this. And I think they're unlike Orwell's book. I think it does, there is an element of hope which comes in towards the end. Not a kind of unqualified hope, but like, but yeah, so I think they're kind of, there's definitely a complicity in all of us, but like, I think that, you know, perhaps if we talk about it in the right way, and don't sort of like condemn people for not being perfect, but sort of encourage people for making an effort and for, you know, being, yeah, I'm gonna get those bracelets, mate, a bit less shit. Then maybe we can turn it around.
You should just get t-shirts, just walk around town. Just kind of quite random, I think. Yeah. Just having t-shirts says a bit less shit.
Yeah.
But it would kind of communicate, I think, a lot of certainly your personality. Yeah. And your values. And great, yeah, you know, I was about to say something, but I'd much rather hear from you. So, yeah, please go.
I think we're in a weird world politically where the right, not just in this country and in America, but in lots of other places in the world, the right have the power, but are framing the left as the enemy, in the sense that the real dangers, that narrative they're spreading, is not, you know, the environment going to shit. It's not about saying election results are fraudulent. It's not any of these things. The real enemy is cancel culture. And that's what they're using. But do you find that sometimes the left are actually playing into the right's hands? And this is also your point of social media, of getting involved in this. But in a way, cancel culture, in a muted down way, is trying to hold people to account, really. But they're doing that by kind of sort of saying, well, they are then not allowed to speak or hold positions of power. I was watching, this is part of the question, and it's a bit rambling, I apologize. I was watching a Q&A with Salman Rushdie, and he was saying that, you know, it's terrible, the books are being banned in Florida, and they're saying, you can't read this. But he was like, another danger is also people accusing writers of cultural appropriation, saying, well, you're a certain kind of person, so you can't write about that kind of person. And the left saying, you can't do this, which is kind of almost the same thing. You can't read this, you can't write this. Do you think there's a way where, sounds a bit dangerous, but in a sense that if you leave everything open to be said, and everything open to be, in a sense, not permissible, but just to be heard without judgment, do you think then people would see it clearly and then go, oh, the real danger is in cancel culture, isn't this? And they start looking at the real issues once everything's died down. But do you think there's a way to do that practically?
I don't know. I think there's a few things. Like, I think concerning terms like cancel culture or sort of, you know, sort of wokeism. How do we say that in France? Wokeism. Do we see them like it? I think it's just, you know, work, you know, the use of the word work. Like, I'm old enough to remember when political correctness went mad. And like, I think there's something that, like, once something has become a sort of a term that can be deployed for more or less everything. Like I remember there's a routine by the comedian Stuart Lee where he talks about, I think it's his mum or his grandma, is like sort of like, oh, like, Stu, they say I can't take the kettle into the bath anymore. That's political correctness gone mad. It's like, no, that's health and safety. But like, and I think we do have a tendency to kind of hook onto these concepts, these ideas, and then just, and I think the right and the right-wing media are very good at this, is kind of putting so much onto them that they become absurd and kind of collapse under the weight of what the concept is expected to encompass. So when, like, I don't think cancel culture, for example, is a particularly useful term anymore, because, you know, it's somebody who used to write for one paper writing an article in another paper and complaining about being cancelled is not the same as somebody who, you know, who works, you know, in an office and tweets a stupid joke, and then for whatever reason that joke gets picked up and they get sort of harried out of their job. But both of those are cancel culture, and we're expected to understand them in the same way. And I think that's really problematic, because I think there's different forces at work and different ways of understanding both of them. I mean, you talked about the left playing into the right's hand. And again, like, you know, I consider myself of the left, I consider people of the left my people, but God, they play into the right's hand. Just sort of all the time, and just sort of like frustratingly so. And I think particularly on subjects of free speech, because I think part of the problem with free speech is that, like, the left in Britain, but I think kind of around the world, are not actually in power that much, like the liberal left. Like, it's actually quite astonishing when you look back at the history of sort of British governments, how little the Labour Party, for example, have been in power, actually. Like, really small proportion of British history. And so I think the danger is, whether in power or not, is that the sort of, if the left use tactics to silence people, suddenly you lose a legitimacy to then say to people on the right, when they use the same tactics, ah, no, you can't do that, we're for free speech. And so, like, you know, I do completely understand why, for example, a lot of the discussions about identity politics and cultural appropriation have come up. And without meaning to kind of blow smoke up Ian's ass, like, he has a chapter on identity politics and how to be a liberal, which I think is a really sort of interesting and nuanced discussion of how that debate arose and perhaps how we can chart a way through that.
I made him say that. So basically, the price of me doing this interview.
But yeah, I think there's sort of, yeah, I suppose I my feeling is that sort of we have to be very careful. Like, you know, there are sometimes very legitimate reasons for providing a framework around free speech, you know, particularly when concerning hate speech or speech, like, you know, there's a whole kind of cliche about, like, shouting fire in a theatre. Like, you know, that's technically free speech, but, you know, it's not not wise to allow that kind of thing. But I mean, my personal position is I would always err on the side of caution and of sort of, and as you said, sort of giving air to opinions so that hopefully they can kind of wither on the vine.
Okay, we have 3 minutes left. If someone wants to do a quick question, they can do it. Yes, hello, you at the back. You at the back, I sound like an auctioneer.
Hi. Yeah, just building on some of the comments, the thing that struck me in the comments this evening, Orwell was writing about the end of aristocracy, basically, and the old ruling families of Europe, and they're being replaced by fascism and communism. It was basically a modernity of politics. But he couldn't see the middle ground between the extreme of fascism. You know, he saw socialism, the promise of democratic socialism. On the one hand, basically Europe was the end of empires and kings and aristocracy was crumbling, and being replaced by 20th century society. But he couldn't really see what was happening very clearly. And he was coming from a quite aristocratic background himself, hence his romanticization of the working class. Yeah? I think we're at a similar point now. I think your book is in a similar position in that we are, with digital society globally, seeing a fragmentation of 20th century political thinking, but we don't know what's going to replace it. And the only society that's really flourishing out of this is China, because they're bypassing that. They're basically preventing that debate from happening.
That's interesting.
And the 21st century will economically be their century.
Yeah.
I thought I said after this photo that no one was allowed to be a student anywhere.
Sorry, I apologize.
You fucked it up.
So my question, a leading one, but do you not think we're in a similar pace of period of confusion and the Western democracies and the digital society, we're at a crossroads, but we don't know what comes next.
Yeah.
Our strength is that we're open to possibilities, you know, compared to China, but it's also our weakness.
It's really interesting. I mean, it's a kind of truism to say it's a bit of a stupid thing to say, but like, of course, nobody knows what's going to come next. And one thing that struck me in reading Orwell again, both before writing this book and in recent weeks, knowing that I would get lots of questions about Orwell, so I kind of had to at least kind of give the impression that I knew what he wrote about, was that his real skill was in description, of seeing what was going on and describing it in a very kind of distilled, very precise way. He was less gifted, I think, in prediction. Like, I think, so he, in for example, The Lion and the Unicorn, like, he has that wonderful sentence where he's talking about sort of British politics, which I think still rings very true, unfortunately, which is sort of, England is like a family with the wrong members in control. You know, it's sort of kind of the, I can't remember his exact turn of phrase, it's wonderful, but like, it's them, like the sclerotic aunts and the mad uncles and things like that. So, yeah, okay, not a great deal has changed there, but the prediction he makes there is that after the Second World War, there's no other path for British society except democratic socialism. Like he writes about it like it's an inevitability. And sure, after the Second World War, there was sort of definitely, you know, with the foundation of the NHS and things like that, there was definitely a move in that direction. But what I don't think he particularly predicted was how, I guess, the resilience of the establishment. And similarly with 1984, in a way, like, I think he did very well at sort of extrapolating from and sort of highlighting the dangers in the systems of totalitarian surveillance states as they existed and were starting to exist at the time that he was writing. What he didn't predict was how...
I'm afraid that's all. At that point, Adam's recorder seems to have stopped working, but it was pretty much the last question. I just want to say thank you again to Ian Dunt and to Adam for such a fascinating conversation. And thank you to you for listening. Goodbye.